this vision of the cherubim and the chariot of the Lord that is mentioned in Ezekiel chapter 1, and in a number of other locations it's mentioned as well in quite a bit of detail. In short, it is a vision of Christ in the kingdom with the immortalized saints. Christ is the angel on the throne. The eyes represent individuals that have been judged worthy and transformed into their glorified immortal state. And the cherubim represent the characteristics of those immortalized saints, the characteristics of a perfect way of living a life, the sorts of characteristics that God is looking for and that God will ultimately achieve in his creation. They're the sorts of characteristics that are symbolized in this vision of the cherubim themselves. The first thing to really emphasize here, that this is a vision. It is not real. Okay? It's a vision with meaning. It's symbolic, very much like the visions that we see in Revelation and other parts of the scriptures as well. The cherubim are a pictorial representation of the principles upon which God intends to redeem individuals from the human race and exalt them to a spirit nature. So they symbolise the sorts of characteristics that God is after. Further on, we looked at the first mention of the cherubim, which is in Genesis chapter 3. And at this time, when Adam and Eve had sinned and they forfeited their right to come into the divine presence of God, and they forfeited their right to access to the tree of life. And so there was this, the reading from Genesis 3 says, "So he drove them out. He drove out the man, and he placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubims and a flaming sword which turned every way to keep the way of the tree of life." And I emphasise there that the cherubim were introduced to keep the way to the tree of life. The cherubim are not there to bar the way to the tree of life. It was Adam and Eve's sin, and it is our sin that actually bars us from the tree of life. But it is what the cherubim symbolise in character that keeps the way to the tree of life. God is more than willing for people to come to the tree of life and have eternal life, but there are certain criteria that God looks for. And those characteristics of people that God is looking for is what's symbolised in the cherubim. I also made mention of this verse out of John chapter 1, verses 1 and verse 14, that says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." From John chapter 1 in reference to Jesus himself. And last time I explained that the cherubim are a template of the ideal characteristics that God wants, and to show that it is possible to achieve that, God sent his son Jesus, a perfect man, the only person who has achieved those sorts of characteristics and ultimately achieved eternal life himself. So Jesus is our teacher in a way. The cherubim are a template, and Jesus is our teacher to show us that it is possible. And how does a person then gain access to the tree of life? We had a look at Revelation 22 and verse 14, where it says, "Blessed are they that do his commandments, that they may have right of way to the tree of life." So in other words, to gain access to the tree of life, it is about doing the commandments of God and of his son Jesus. And certainly we can't consider the cherubim of Genesis chapter 3 without, obviously, thinking about Jesus, because it was Jesus who did his Father's commandments so perfectly that he's actually been placed in the position as judge. And through him we can gain access to this tree of life. So it is Christ that is the way. Christ is the door. We saw that from Further on, there's another reference here to John 14, verse 6, where we looked at where Jesus says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me." So it is through Jesus' example that we can follow to ultimately obtain salvation. So then we started to look at some of the detail of Ezekiel chapter 1, and we didn't cover all of these things. We looked at this whirlwind out of the north, and considered the reference in Isaiah chapter 66, where it mentions from verse 15, "For behold, the Lord will come with fire and with his chariots like a whirlwind, to render his anger with fury and his rebuke with flames of fire." And we talked about how, you know, the whirlwinds have such destructive forces, like those tornadoes that go across America. That's fairly common. Further on, we considered the great cloud, and the great cloud being the whole collective of saints that have been called together. A few references here about the great cloud that we considered last time in Psalm 72. "He shall come down like rain upon the mown grass, as showers that water the earth." Also from 1 Thessalonians, "We shall be caught up in clouds to meet the Lord in the air." And then in Revelation 1, 7, it says, "Behold, he cometh with clouds." And the clouds are symbolic of the mass of a multitude of called out saints. The millions of people essentially throughout the generations who ultimately will achieve salvation. We then considered this fire that's mentioned in Ezekiel chapter 1, the reference there in 1 Corinthians, "Every man's work shall be made manifest, the fire shall try every man's work. If any man's work abide, he shall receive a reward. If any man's work be burned, he shall suffer loss. But he himself shall be saved, yet so as by fire." And the fire symbolises this judgment, this trying of our faith. It's a purification process, isn't it? That purges away all the dross and impurities of life. But the fire is also a very destructive thing, and we considered how this fire talks about how it's enfolding on itself, and how we don't see this sort of this power of fire on the earth here, except maybe in some of the big bushfires that occur, and this idea of how the fire is so active and yet so agile in the way that it moves around between trees, and the way it's so destructive. And these are all symbolisms of the force in which Christ and the saints will have to take over the world. And because last time we considered how that the world will not just sit back and let Christ and the saints take over the governments of this world. They will resist, and Christ and the saints will have to take over rule with force. And then out of this background, we see these living creatures. Ezekiel chapter 1 mentions that they are living creatures. Other parts of Ezekiel mention that they are the cherubim. Ezekiel 10 verse 15, it says, "And the cherubims were lifted up. This is the living creature that I saw by the river of Kibar." So we know that Ezekiel chapter 1 talks about the cherubim, as the other references of Ezekiel do as well. And then we moved on and we had a look at the four faces of the cherubim: the lion, the ox, the man, and the eagle. And how these four faces are really getting into the nitty-gritty of the type of characteristics that we need to strive for, and that God will ultimately achieve in his creation. The lion symbolising strength, fearlessness and courage. The ox, patience, working, enduring. An ox stands very confidently and strong. The man, who is accountable to God's law. Mankind being the key aspect of God's creation, and mankind being the only part of God's creation that is accountable to God under his laws, and ultimately the only part of his creation that will achieve salvation. Then there was the eagle, and we discussed how the eagle symbolising spiritual aspects and the spiritual sorts of characteristics that God is looking for. And we looked at how the eagle has such marvellous sight, and that it's able to see things that other animals and other birds can't. And we considered that on a spiritual aspect, how we as you know, sons and daughters of God, from what we know of the scriptures, we can see things in the world that so many other people in the world cannot see. And so already we have developed some of these characteristics in what we can see. So that was where we sort of finished it last time, starting to see what the image was about and starting to get a feel for some of these characteristics. And I want to move on now to look at this idea of developing character and what this means. Sorry, just before we do move on, I've listed there on the slide as well, as we did last time, that the four faces of the cherubim are linked to the four Gospels, which also symbolise the aspects of Jesus' life. So Matthew emphasises the kingly aspects of Jesus' mission, which is the lion. Mark's account of the Gospel is one of service and action, the ox. Luke emphasises the human aspect of Jesus' Gospel, the man, and John brings out the divine spiritual side of the work of Christ, which is the eagle. So ideally, we should have a fairly balanced development of each of these characteristics, but realistically, we don't. We all tend to sort of lean one way or the other. And so when we think about these characteristics, reminded me of the pyramid process or application, in that pyramid's got these four sides, and ideally we want to be like on the pinnacle of the pyramid, where we have equal amounts of these characteristics represented by the lion, the ox, the man, and the eagle. Generally, most of us will tend to sway one way or the other in one particular direction. But what's been shown to us from the cherubim is that ultimately these characteristics we will all achieve in equal proportions, because it's important that we do have each of these characteristics equal. It doesn't work well if, let's say, we have a lot of the sort of lion characteristic in us, that we have a lot of the sort of courage and come out showing leadership all the time. If we don't have a lot of compassion or some compassion for our fellow man, or if we don't have enough spiritual aspect in our characteristic as well, or if we don't have the sort of ox type characteristic of the worker, someone who is patient and diligent and being involved in everything. And the same goes for any of those, that we can swing one way or the other. But ideally, we should be on that pinnacle where we have an equal balance of all four of these characteristics. Before we sort of go into those too much, we'll have a look at, what is character? Character refers to a set of moral and mental qualities and beliefs that makes a person different from others. Our character is a result of the experiences and social interactions in our life. As opposed to someone's personality, our personality is the outer appearance and behaviour that we exhibit. So we're talking during the study specifically about our characteristics. And I've been at Heritage a lot this week, preparing for the Year 3-5 play. And so a lot of aspects around schooling has made me think about some of these things, and how that as students, but even as adults, we all learn differently. Some of us learn a lot and develop through direct instruction, having things just explained to us. Some of us learn better through demonstration, having somebody show us how things work or show us the way in life. And then others of us learn more from participation, actually the experience, getting involved in something. We have to do things for ourselves before the lessons of life really sink in. So it is that we all learn things differently, and obviously so it is in general life, that we need either instruction or demonstration or participation. And thinking about these as well, I got to thinking about that there are personality character assessments that are available, where people can do these surveys to understand, you know, what are their character traits, things like that. One of the most common ones is the Myers-Briggs assessment. You answer a series of questions, and from the results you get to understand whether you're more of an introvert or extrovert, or whether you have more of a sensing or intuition type character, whether you're more of a feeling or a thinking person, or whether you're more of a judging or perceiving type person. So these are the Myers-Briggs type indicators. There are many others. Just to name a few of them here, there's the Carey Newhoff 9 character test, which interestingly, I did find that quite interesting. The 9 character test is based on a lot of scriptural aspects, was put together by a minister. Probably worth looking at in a little bit more detail. There's the Jungian archetype test, disc assessment, Winslow, Holtzman inkblot, Hexaco, Berkman method, and the Enneagram tests. And all of these assessments are to help people understand what sort of character or personality they have. One which came out of the Carey Newhoff 9 character test, just to give you an example, was a question that said, it wasn't necessarily a question, but somebody had made a comment about you can learn an awful lot about a person by what they do with the shopping trolley after they've finished with it at the supermarket. And it was like, now that's interesting, you know, as to whether people just sort of discard the trolley into the parking lot next to them, or whether they go and put it away in the rack somewhere, or whether they actually go and return it to the shop so it's most convenient for the next person to use. So they're the sorts of questions that many of these things come up with. They're somewhat abstract sometimes, but worth thinking about, because these are the things that, you know, the everyday activities of life that do test our characteristics. And the way we respond to these everyday events of life is what shows forth our character. Character is something that we have inside of us. It has a lot of influence over us as well. It is not knowledge. Our character is quite different from knowledge. So I've just put up on the screen there a little comment that I came across is, your competency will take you only as far as your character will sustain you. And what that's saying is that you can have a lot of knowledge or be very competent at something, very skilled at something, but if you don't have the right character that's driving you from the inside, then your competency will only go so far. It won't get you that sort of ultimate sort of utopian or ultimate experience what you're trying to achieve with your competency or your skill or your knowledge. It is your character that takes you that extra mile. They often, and I'm sure Graham will attest to this, when it comes to doing interviews for people, someone's character is far more important to understand than their knowledge or skill set. You can teach someone extra knowledge or extra skill, but if they don't have the right character, then they won't go very far at all. Okay, so that's something around the personality tests. So I'm just going to come back to this definition of character. So it refers to a set of moral and mental qualities and beliefs that makes a person different from others. It is a result of the experiences and social interactions in our life. As I mentioned earlier, we all learn and develop differently. Some of us like direct instruction, some like demonstrations, some of us require participation. And when you're at school, it's a sort of a safe environment. So what I want to do is I want to give you an example of something that sort of sprang to mind a little while ago. Jacob came home and he said, "Oh, Dad, guess what? In tech studies today, I got to use an angle grinder." What, year 10 student doesn't want to use an angle grinder? Anyway, he talked about how, you know, using the angle grinder, you know, you got onto the metal and, you know, sparks shooting off from the side. And you sort of think, okay, you know, he's in the tech studies class, the teacher's standing there, student comes along, says, "Great, I want to use an angle grinder." And the teacher's going, okay, assess the situation. You know, he's going to start it up on something, sparks are going to come off there, where are the sparks going to go? Over fellow students, maybe, over some other kid's work, or is somebody else using some flammable liquids there, this type of thing. So the teacher's already got these things in mind. And the teacher goes, okay, looks like a safe environment to be able to do this, knowing full well what's going to happen. And of course, any tech studies teacher knows what's going to happen when a year 10 student comes along, grabs the angle grinder, and sparks shoot off across the bench there. It's a safe environment. The teacher understands what's going on. Now, this is why we read this chapter here around John chapter 17. Because we are in a safe environment. We are in this world. And that might sound a little bit unusual to say that it's a safe environment. But there's a number of things to consider. In this chapter that we read here, in verse 15, Jesus says, "I pray not that thou should takest them out of the world, but that thou shouldest keep them from the evil one," or from evil. We are in this world to experience things, to learn things, to be involved with other people in the world, to engage in things. And all of this is important for the development of our character. And Jesus understood that. But we do know from other parts of Scripture that God will not test us more than we are able to withstand. And with that in mind, we should have far more courage to go and preach the word. We should be far more braver to go and visit people who need help and to talk to people who need help. We should be far more willing to go and be involved in activities, because we know that the situations of this world are not going to try us more than we are able to, and that with every situation that we find ourselves in, that there is a way of escape to avoid actually sinning. And so Jesus here says that he knows that we have to be in this world for in order to us to grow. And I want to take this back even further to think a little bit more along the lines of the time of creation. And when Adam and Eve were given a command to not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And in essence, it was a safe environment. God was starting with his creation with a small test. He didn't hit Adam and Eve with some huge complex temptation that was going to be, you know, way too difficult for them. He started off with a small test. And we do that with students at school, don't we? We introduce them to different things a little bit at a time until we know that they've learnt enough, that their character has developed enough, that they can start to make the right sort of decisions for themselves as they begin to grow. And God was the same with Adam and Eve. Now, just like the tech studies teacher seeing a student with an angle grinder for the first time, the tech studies teacher knows what's going to happen. He knows that as soon as that student with the angle grinder gets onto the metal, sparks will go shooting across the desk. But he understands the risks and he's got a plan in case something goes wrong. And God was the same. When Adam and Eve sinned and partook of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, God knew it was going to happen. He knows our nature so well that when Adam and Eve were given that, he knew what was going to happen. And right from the beginning, God has a plan. And his plan involved putting forward the cherubim as a template to say, these are the sorts of characteristics that I'm looking for. His plan also included his son, Jesus, as a teacher to come later to show that it is possible to obtain perfection. God had a plan right from the beginning, not just for Adam and Eve, but for the whole of mankind, including us. And in this chapter that we read tonight, Jesus understood all of that. Further on in the chapter, when Jesus starts to pray, where he says in verse 20, "Neither I pray for these alone, but for them also which shall believe on me through their word." So he's talking about us in this situation, in that we believed on Jesus through the word of the apostles who were with him. And then Jesus says, "That they may be one, as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee." Jesus emphasises this whole aspect of oneness that he has with his Father. And Jesus understood what the whole vision of the cherubim was about, what the chariot of the Lord was about. It's about this unity, that all of the saints would be immortalised in a single unity with Jesus and with God. Now, of course, we can't achieve that now, but it's what we have to strive for. And while I'm suggesting that, I'll put forward, just to test out or to have you think a little bit differently about things, is that I'd suggest that what our goal is in life is not actually to be in the kingdom. Although, yes, we want to be in the kingdom, but just think about, what is it that we can do to obtain entry into the kingdom? There isn't really anything we can do. We know that we can't get to the kingdom on our own. That the gift of the kingdom is just that. It is a gift. God is willing that everyone should obtain access into the kingdom. He's willing to give it to us. But he says there are certain characteristics that we must develop. And I'd suggest that our goal in life is to develop the right characteristics. We see it in sports players as a bit of an example. They often don't spend a lot of time visualising what the actual winning cup or something like this. They spend an awful lot of time developing their character and their mindset to be the best that they can in their competitions. Sorry, there's just this other thing there about personality. Okay. The other thing I'd like to mention about that in regards to how we develop our characteristics, and I talked earlier about how We all learn in different ways. Some of us like instructions, some of us need demonstrations, some of us need participation. But ultimately, when we're learning things, if we think about the Year 10 Tech Studies students, they will all approach learning about how to use an angle grinder in different ways. And that goes for all of us as well. We all take slightly different paths in life. We all have to experience some things differently to other people because that's what we need as individuals. Some of us just need things in life simply explained to us and we understand them. Some of us need to go out and actually experience these things in life before we realise that they're either right or wrong. It's a challenge, It's risky, but that's how we all develop. So we all take very slightly different paths along to the same point. Ideally, we should be taking the one straight path, shouldn't we? But we are mortal creatures at this stage, and so we will deviate on and off that path at different times. So if you would, come back to Ezekiel chapter 1. So we're going to carry on a little bit looking at a couple of the details of Ezekiel 1. Well, I was just talking about how that we all take, you know, we all sort of deviate off the path a little bit and take detours in life. Ezekiel 1 verse 7, when it's talking about the cherubim, it says, "And their feet were straight feet, and the sole of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like the colour of burnished brass." Oops. They had straight feet. The use of the word straight, which means right or upright, is suggestive of the type of walk that we should have, the type of walk that is expected of those who follow the ways of God. I've got on the screen there a reference from Proverbs chapter 4, verse 18 and verses 25 to 27, which reads, "But the path of the just is as the shining light, that shineth more and more unto the perfect day. Let thine eyes look right on, and let thine eyelids look straight before thee. Ponder the path of thy feet, and let all the ways be established. Turn not to the right hand nor to the left, remove thy foot from evil." Certainly we know that animals with the cloven feet are very careful where they place their feet, aren't they? It's very rare that some of those animals would trip or fall. They pick their way very carefully, avoiding obstacles in their path. And so we must do the same in our lives, picking our way carefully to avoid these obstacles, the temptations that are going to lead us to sin. As we read in the chapter earlier on, Jesus prayed that we should not be taken out of this world, but simply to be kept from the evil. Further on, we see that the image has hands of a man, which is in verse 8 of Ezekiel 1. "And they had the hands of a man under their wings on their four sides, and they four had their faces and their wings." The human hand is one of the most marvellous tools in the world. The dexterity of fingers, how we can move them. When it's linked to an intelligent mind, there's almost no end to what we can create with our hands, is there? We see today that man has the ability to create some of the most amazing things. He also has the ability to create some of the most destructive things that have existed in this world. But ultimately, in the kingdom, these hands symbolise work being done by man for the benefit of the human race, when they will use their hands to beat their swords into ploughshares and their spears into pruning hooks. They symbolise work for the glorification of the Lord, of God. As it says on the screen, human activities controlled by the divine principles indicated by the faces upon the heads. Those characteristics driving the activities. And once again, Jesus was the highest example of this in his life, how he was a perfect man that did all the right things for other people. Why? Jesus came not to do his own will, but to do the will of him who sent him, the will of God. It is all about service to God in the kingdom, and that's what this vision is showing us. Further on in the chapter, we have reference to the eyes. in verse 12 as well. Sorry, that was the wheel. Sorry, not verse 12. I've got a wrong verse there. That's all right. We'll come back to it. Okay, so there's reference to the eyes here. The eye is really one of the most wonderful parts of our bodies, isn't it? In the way that it lets light into the body. It's a receiver of impressions. It conveys to the brain through the optic nerve. It reacts to light. It only works in light. It doesn't work in darkness. And I think that's important when thinking about the fact that Jesus is the light of the world. Our eyes should be taking in that light. Our eyes can see things that are a long way off. They can see things that are up close in the way that it can use the delicate focusing lens. It's able to print pictures on the mind that don't fade, that stay with us for the rest of our lives. The eyes are also able to reflect a person's state of mind, whether it be love, joy, hope, grief or anger. And there's many other thoughts about the eyes. A few verses here on the screen. The light of the body...
Verse 18.
Sorry, thank you. It's all right. The reference is on the screen. From Matthew 6:22, it says, "The light of the body is the eye. If therefore thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light." Also from John chapter 1 verse 4, "In him was life, and the life was the light of men." There's many other thoughts. On a spiritual plane, we can begin to see what God wants and wants us to understand. The vast majority of mankind is without a vision, aren't they? They have no vision. We know that from the scriptures tell us, you know, where there is no vision, the people perish. In the kingdom, the saints will be showing people the vision of Christ and of God. They will be showing people who Jesus really is, saying, "Look, see, here is Jesus, the Son of God. Come to Jerusalem to see him." It's important that people can see, that they have a vision. The eyes of this vision tell us. Also, there further on is the reference to the firmament. In verses 22 to 23, it reads, "And the likeness of the firmament upon the heads of the living creatures was as the colour of terrible crystal stretched forth over the heads above. And under the firmament were the wings straight, the one toward the other. Every one had two which covered on this side, and every one had two which covered on that side their bodies." The firmament indicates to us a position of power and honour that was above these creatures. Daniel 12 verse 3 reads, "And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn away, or that turn many to righteousness, as the stars forever and ever." Ezekiel saw a firmament. The making of the firmament constituted the second day's work of creation, as recorded in Genesis chapter 1. And it was in this expanse that God placed the light of the day and the light of the night in the firmament. The light of the world. We know how often the heavens are frequently referred to, figuratively, to signify positions of power and authority and honour. And that's what we see here in this image. The firmament is referring to this power and honour. Jesus, in his parable of the tares, after he said, "The harvest is the end of the world," added, "Then shall the righteous shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father." This idea of shining forth in the firmament. So the throne indicates royalty, authority, and heavenly majesty. That was the throne which is above the firmament. It's this divine kingdom, the kingdom of God, ruled by Christ at the time in the future. And as we know, the man sitting on there is Christ. He is the rainbowed angel. Further on in Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 28, there is this appearance of this bow that is in the cloud, the rainbow. We know that the rainbow was introduced into this picture for the same reason that it appears in Revelation and also in Ezekiel 10, chapter 1. It's a picture of God's judgment, but also it's a reminder of God's covenant word, that God's covenant will never fail. God introduced it after the flood as a symbol. And God said to Noah, "When I bring a cloud over the earth, the bow shall be seen in the cloud, and I will look upon it, and I may remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature that is upon the earth." And so once again, the bow in the image, the rainbow, reminds us of the everlasting covenant with God. And finally, we have this reference to the wheels in this image. They occupy an important place in the vision. They're mentioned at some length here in chapter 1 and also in chapter 10. And the wheels and the creatures are all part of the same image. The whole image fits together. One doesn't move without the other. They all move together. And the wheel is this basis of movement and speed. Wheels within wheels. When we think about mankind's invention of a wheel, it's fairly inefficient. It rotates in one direction, and if we want to change course, there's an awful lot of energy expelled in trying to change course with our idea of a wheel. But in this vision, it's wheels within wheels, and they don't have to turn. They move in any direction. They faced in every direction as well. And I felt it was a fitting symbol the wheel is a fitting symbol of eternity, and therefore of the spirit power, which is from everlasting to everlasting. This spirit power that can move anywhere within the world. It doesn't stay in just one direction. We know that wheels or circles have no ending. They are continuous. And these wheels were full of eyes, representing the saints. So in other words, the saints are moving throughout the world in every direction. There's no specific path. They go everywhere. So that sort of covered what Ezekiel chapter 1 says about the cherubim and this overall chariot of the Lord. It's interesting that the cherubim is mentioned throughout the Old Testament. The word is used quite frequently. There are references in the New Testament, but there is only one reference to the word cherubim in the New Testament. And what we've seen so far from the cherubim is from the vision in Ezekiel chapter 1 is the depiction of the type of characteristics that we need, but also this vision of the unification of the saints, and how that we will all ultimately in the kingdom have the same characteristics in equal proportions, and that we will all be working for the Lord, doing the work of God throughout the world. Paul refers to the cherubims. He understood this concept of what the vision was about. In Hebrews chapter 9, he makes reference to it in verse 5, where he says, "And over it the cherubims of glory, shadowing the mercy seat, of which we cannot now speak particularly." So in other words, he's saying, I don't have the time to speak about the cherubim in detail. specifically here, he is referring to the cherubim over the mercy seat in the temple. We obviously don't have time to cover that in much detail either. But they all do link together further on. But anyway, so Paul refers to the cherubim there. Further on in chapter 10, when he is expressing his understanding to the Hebrews about what he sees the vision is and what we now understand of it, he's saying, "Let us now hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering, for he is faithful that promised. And let us consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works." Verse 25, "And not forsaking the assembly of ourselves together, as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as ye see the day approaching." A couple of key things I want to pull out of this, and Ben highlighted one of them last week after the class, specifically out of verse 24 there. It says, "And let us consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works." A key aspect about the cherubim, particularly on the mercy seat there, is that they faced each other. And the cherubim in the vision of Ezekiel chapter 1 was the same. They faced each other. They have a face of a man as well. They faced each other like we face each other. And it is so important that we look out for each other, that we need to encourage each other along this journey, that we're not on this journey alone. We're not here just to develop these characteristics on our own, but we are here to help each other. And Paul emphasised this fact. But not just the fact that we're helping each other, but we are in the last days. Verse 25, I'll read it again. "Not forsaking the assembly of ourselves together, as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as ye see the day approaching." We can see that the return of Christ is very soon to come. And with that in mind, we should be encouraging each other even more to learn about these things and to develop our characteristics. Because developing the right characteristics is what our goal should be. Those characteristics symbolised in the cherubim. Now, the whole vision of the cherubim is a little bit of a bittersweet prophecy. Because as we talked earlier about this vision of the chariot of the Lord, it comes with this whirlwind and this fire and this force. And then we start to see the detail of the saints, the type of characteristics that they will have. Ultimately, that is the unification. But I want to leave you with a slightly different vision of it as well. I want you to think about what that will be like in our city. When Christ returns and the saints are called, and then the saints go out into the world, those eyes and the wheels, they go out into the world. Consider what it would be like for tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of immortalized saints descending upon Adelaide and systematically working their way through every house and every street in every suburb and seeking out and exposing the evil of this world to clean it up and to get rid of it and to save those who have been held captive both physically and mentally, to care for the sick and the needy, to teach and instruct the world about our new King, Jesus. Because that's what it will be like when our characters are unified as immortalized saints, when we go and do the work of the Lord in the kingdom. Thank you.